This episode is brought to you by Element, spelled L-M-N-T. What is Element? It's a delicious sugar-free electrolyte drink mix. As a coach, we are constantly trying to find the best products for our athletes to train and compete at their highest level. Element is a great alternative to other commercial recovery and performance drinks and has enough sodium, potassium, and magnesium to get you feeling and performing your best. Plus, it has zero sugar, no artificial ingredients, and is gluten-free. With eight delicious flavors, you are guaranteed to find one your taste buds will love. I know our athletes love the citrus salt. We keep a variety box in the office, and our athletes stop by every day on their way to practice and games to load up. At this point, they won't even touch another product. With amazing products and sponsors like Element, our podcast would not be possible. Right now, when you click on our affiliate link and place your first Element order, Element will give us 100% commission. Element might have the best return policy on the planet. If you don't love it, you'll be instantly refunded.
Our next partner has a product I use every day. I started taking Athletic Greens because I wanted a simple all-in-one solution as opposed to the ever-changing variety of supplements I have been taking for as long as I can remember. Sometimes up to 3 ramekins a day full of pills and powders trying to find the right formula for peak performance. Now that I've been taking Athletic Greens for a few months, I love it and I will never go back. With one delicious scoop of Athletic Greens, you're absorbing 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food-sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens to help you start your day right. This special blend of ingredients supports your gut health, your nervous system, your immune system, your energy, recovery, focus, and aging. I take one scoop in the morning on an empty stomach, and an additional one in the evening when I am feeling run down. I've seen such a difference in my own performance that I recently ordered additional AG1 for the rest of my family to use. It costs you less than $3 a day, you're investing in your health, and it's cheaper than your cold brew habit and supports better sleep quality and recovery in addition to mental clarity and alertness. Right now, it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. It's just one scoop and a cup of water every day. That's it. No need for a million different pills and supplements to look out for your health. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free 1-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/contacts. Again, this is athleticgreens.com/contacts to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. Welcome to the Contacts Coaching Podcast, dedicated to bringing you practical ideas from coaches, sharing what they have learned throughout their career. The show is designed to serve as a digital database of mentorship from a wide network of coaches whose innovative, reflective, and diverse knowledge may offer ideas to enhance your experience. In addition to sport-specific expertise, each episode also dives into the ways in which culture, strategy, and tactics can cross from one discipline to another. I'm your host, Justin Klein.
Welcome back to the Contacts Coaching Podcast. We are joined today by Nate Gregory, former head baseball coach at Modesto Junior College. Coach, thanks for joining us today. Really excited to have you on.
My pleasure. I appreciate you having me.
All right, let's dive in here. Why don't you take us through your background as a coach? How'd you get into this journey, shall we say? When did that start? And take us through the stops along the way.
Yeah, I was a little different background. I went to Modesto Junior College out of high school. And like most 17-year-olds, I wasn't filled out and wasn't quite physically mature enough to handle being a collegiate athlete at that point. So I ended up in the military for a few years, stationed at 101st Airborne Division at Fort Campbell. And it was a good experience for me growing up a little bit, learning how to be, handle my business, grow some thick skin. So it was pretty good option for me at that time. When I got out, I ended up playing at San Joaquin Delta College for a guy named Pat Doyle. He was an ABCA Hall of Fame guy, tremendous teacher, an even better friend now at this point in my life, but quite a bit of influence on my coaching style, the things that I value. And yeah, definitely had a huge influence on me. And then played some collegiate ball and got out and wasn't really planning on coaching. one of the guys that I was really close with in high school took a head coaching job in Idaho. And I had finished my playing career at that point, and he asked me to come out and be his pitching coach. Went out there and got my feet wet a little bit, pretty young. Didn't quite know what I was doing, but not too bad. Successful enough, developing some guys that year. And then I moved back home and wasn't going to coach. My dad was playing golf, ran into the head coach at a local high school. They needed some help. So I did a couple years there. And then I got married, wife got pregnant with twins, and was never going to coach again. They were born 3 months early, went through hospital stuff. So that year I wasn't around the game at all. Spent time with my wife and my kids. And then I got a phone call from the head coach at Oakdale, and then it progressed from there. So I was out there 15 years total, 14 coaching. I did 10 years as a pitching coach, and then I took over as a head coach for my last four. So that's how I got off the ground. And then Modesto Junior College, one of my former teammates took the job there and then offered me the pitching coach position there. So that's where everything led, back from the military on into the coaching world.
And then you spent the last few years as the interim head coach, correct?
This last season, yeah. It was a good year, good group of tough kids. Obviously, there was a lot of arm injuries everywhere. And so we were down a few arms or whatever, but we had some guys that got tough this year. Stretch themselves a little bit. I think won our first playoff series for the first time in 20 years and enjoyed the hell out of coaching those guys.
Love it. You just brought something up that's unique to baseball that I'm always curious about because I'm not a baseball guy per se, but let's talk about arm injuries, shall we? I would love to get your take on what has become the norm in baseball in regards to trying to manage arms, which those of you that are not aware, in softball, you really only need one pitcher. In baseball, everyone needs to pitch. Talk a little bit about the shift and what is the impact that you have observed in your coaching from when we grew up and they just threw people however much they wanted to now where people are on these hard pitch counts and what, yes, both the positives and the negatives of that approach.
Yeah, I think the biggest shift I've seen is how much they're throwing. I think when we were kids, we're all three sport athletes. We played football, basketball, whatever it was. We weren't one sport guys typically. And then what's going on now with all the lessons and the driveline stuff, arm care and velocity programs. I think that if there was a pitch counter on these young men compared to what we did specifically with baseball, I think that's what shifted quite a bit. And being able to manage all that as a parent, even my nephews, they'll guest play with somebody. That coach may not know, hey, that kid threw four innings 3 days ago and then roll him out on a Sunday for 60 pitches. So I think there's a lot of things that get missed because it's not consistent all the time. And the management of how much they're doing and the intensity of that, I think has had a real profound effect on the arm injuries for sure.
Yeah. So your take basically is, because these kids have gotten sucked into the sports specificity and year-round approach, they're actually throwing more regardless of the pitch counts that we're now holding them to than we did growing up.
Yeah, your body needs time to recover from something like that. Those are small tendons and ligaments. And like for us, I wouldn't touch a ball for 3 or 4 months. And your body had time to recoup before you went back to that activity. So I think that's
it. And I think there's something to be said for that. Our team just finished up. We had a late run in the playoffs that we've never had before. And I think a big part of that was our top two pitchers were multi-sport dudes that just went out there and threw it. And our best player was the county athlete of the year and was the MVP of the football team, the basketball team, and the baseball team, and the throwback guy.
That's it.
Yeah, and I think your take on that is interesting because usually people get caught up in the numbers and whether these pitch counts are helpful, and I hadn't even thought of that approach, which is the natural time off that we once had by being multidisciplinary. On that note, I'd be curious then to know what your approach as a pitching coach is to navigating the modern landscape, knowing what you know about rest and how important it is for these kids to do other things. How do you coach your kids? How do you advise them? How do you fight the youth sports industrial complex that's taken over?
Yeah, I think with the junior college kids, obviously, even with the high school kids, but it's real specific to the individual. what their body's capable of doing, how much they're capable of repeating actions in a healthy way. Like, for example, I had a lefty this year that I'd roll him out of the pen twice a week and maybe one or two innings early in the week. And he might go four innings in game three if I needed him to, but he had 4 days rest. Arm was like a rubber band. So very different than maybe a couple of our starting pitchers that are max effort kind of guys. I can get 85, 90 pitches out of them, but they need 6 days to recover. So a little bit different guy to guy on how I approach that. Obviously, we'd like guys to be able to throw 100 pitches consistently and whatever, but most of these guys aren't capable of that yet and doing it correctly. So I think looking at those individual traits is a big cue for me on where I go with each guy. Is how much throwing, how much log toss, when am I going to pin them, how many pitches in the pen, what do we need to improve, or are we just doing short box and working on spin? So day to day, that changes week to week, depending on where the kid's going developmentally.
I was watching our guys through the playoffs, and I was having a conversation with our assistant, and part of it was just me noticing, if you add up all the warm-up pitches as well that happen every inning, they have the long toss that's going on before the game, these pitch counts, they're theoretically thought out, but they're not taking into account all the other throws that are going on during the day. How do you work with these athletes to give them some emotional intelligence and social awareness of how they got to take care of themselves? Talk about the approach to that and how you educate athletes into arm care.
Very different between the two levels for me. The high school kids is more of a direct approach where I'm giving the guidelines because they really don't know what they're doing. Where the junior college guys is a lot more individual feedback. I like sitting one-on-one. Hey, where are you at this week? Especially with the two-way guy. Our right fielder was a closer, had some arm, had back issues, whatever, which led to an arm issue. Those kinds of things where I've got to sit and map it out with them to get the buy-in on that, whatever we're planning for that week for them. So that's probably where I've changed the most is with the communication and how much of it I get from the player and incorporate that into that plan.
So 10 years as a high school coach, four of them as a head coach. Talk to me a little bit about what you changed going from the high school level to the college level, both tactically and let's call it psychologically. What would you say was the biggest shift in your approach, not just as a pitching coach, but in general as a coach?
Both stops, we spent a lot of time focusing on mental stuff. So a lot of classroom time. Baseball is one of those things you can be out there for 3 hours, but usually that last hour you're stretching thin, especially with high school kids. Practice would be shorter, but the college guys, we planned one day a week where we're in the classroom discussing those kinds of things and going through it. I gave them all, I don't know if you heard of Angela Duckworth, the grit test. So this is my first year doing this with them. I gave them all the grit test and looking at the mean scores. How tough are we? Is the kid adaptable? Discussing them, because you get it with college athletics, there's going to be some failure involved in whatever you're doing. And how do I recognize what's going on and why, and what's my adjustment? How am I going to fix that under duress in competition? I think that's the biggest thing we were able to hammer out. And that toughness really festered in the group this year, I felt.
So what would a classroom session look like when you're introducing Angela Duckworth's grit and trying to build some of that within these athletes? But what else would you do in the classroom? How would you utilize this throughout the course of the year?
I might look at a specific trait within the game of baseball as far as execution, what happens with heart rate, resting heart rate, breaking down. What are my coping skills for that? You know, what I used to step off the rubber and wipe the rubber clean. I'd erase it. Looking for a focal point. Where am I going with my mind when I pick up that focal point and regroup my brain after I just walked a guy in a tie game or something like that? But trying to develop those skills.
Yeah, I'm going to pivot here because you said something that triggered a different thought in me, and I don't really know what you said, but it got me to, when you were talking about wiping the rubber off and then refocusing on spot. And for some reason, my mind went to, how do you simplify pitching when I can sit there and throw front toss all day underhand because I coached softball for 4 years, but I can't throw the ball in the same spot overhand to save my life. So how do you simplify things within that arm movement, which some would say is pretty unnatural, in a way in which it becomes repeatable? What are some of the cues that you've figured out over 20 years of doing this that always seem to land well?
I think they're tedious drills, but putting things in your daily work, like reverse mechanics, starting at the finish point. Where's my hand path? That's the end portion of the delivery, but I want to reverse it from there and then backtrack myself through the mechanics and figure out, okay, where's my front side going now? What's that do to my hand path? Various things like that, where a kid has to repeat those actions correctly over and over.
I like that concept, reverse mechanics. Have you done this with other aspects of the game or other sports you've coached over the years? How is this transferable?
I'll be honest with you. I didn't start that until I went over to MJC. Typically at Oakdale, we had a lot of staffs that threw a lot of strikes. I didn't have control issues with three or four pitchers, and they got a lot of one-on-one time with me anyways in the bullpen. So it was easier to clean up. But when you got 20 pitchers, 15 active and 5 red shirts down there, you got to create ways within the practice plan where they're getting all those reps. Otherwise I'd be down in the bullpen forever trying to manage those specific actions that you're looking for in the development, partnering them up, their daily work. Okay, we're going 7 reps at each phase, 5 different stops in the reverse mechanics. This is what we're doing today. And then if a kid maybe has problems with the takeout, so it causes his hand to be late in the delivery, you've got 10 flips out of the glove. I want to see the right actions in leg lift. Where's your leg at when you take the hand out? So we create connections with those cues that come up in a game where they might be late and missing with pitches, things like that.
All right, here's a question for you from a coaching and teaching standpoint. How do you speak to / instruct athletes that are more literal, meaning what you just said would totally confuse and perplex some athletes as they try to do all those things at once? So where have you found the sweet spot with working with them that are a little more literal and actually get frozen through those instructions? What hacks have you discovered?
Yeah. Okay. Specifically, there's a kid that's pitching in the Yankee organization now, Blaine Abeda, and he had those issues. He was big league arm, couldn't feel his body. So I created a couple different drills really based around him to repeat front foot pickups. So it challenged him to get his hand in line in the finish where he's got to tap the ground out in front of him, then back into his load. Then he could throw things like that. The deadlift throws where we get into it as you work your way up with your glove and the ball, glove in one hand, ball in the other hand. As they raise up, there's a power position somewhere in there, and teaching kids, hey, this is where you need to be when you get in your load. This is where you're going to be most explosive. But simple things like that, and just try not to overload them like you're talking about mentally. So it's a simple drill. We're just going to focus on this drill until we get this portion right.
Yeah, it's something that as a parent, I noticed with my children where my eldest is super literal. And if you give her multiple cues, she's trying to do all of them. My middle child is super conceptual and just figures it out and could care less what you're coaching her. And my youngest is a combination of the two. And he's, you know, what I think what you just said landed for me. He couldn't feel his body. So he doesn't understand all the time what's going on, even when you show it to them. So it's like, how do you reach those athletes? What are the skills? And are you aware, right, as we've gotten old, that there are different learning preferences? And are you meeting each of those kids where they are? Because that's not what we once did. What would you say, besides this kid who's pitching for the Yankees, let's go into your high school career, maybe were some moments that alerted you to the need to approach things differently?
I'll be honest, I failed at this one too. There's a kid that probably the hardest throwing kid I ever coached, had a scholarship to USC, but I could never get him to slow down enough to repeat a delivery. One of the really high baseball IQ, even as a freshman in high school, but wanted to go so fast and so hard that there was no feel there, you know? And so no matter what I tried to do, I had him tutor my son in math, sit in my classroom, try to create connections, do different things. So if I could get to the trust part, then maybe I get a different result out of that kid, because he was probably the most gifted kid we had come through there.
I don't think it's always that simple either, though. I was telling my son again, where when I've worked with, say, like a Pilates instructor, I have to physically have them put their hands on me to put me in the right position, because I can't necessarily execute the verbal instruction until I know what it feels like. So even if you had the trust, if we weren't scratching the right itch, so to speak, it's always tough to get them where we need them to go. Let me go back to your time at the high school level, since you probably dealt with more multi-sport athletes there than at the junior college level. What would you say is the biggest difference between the kids that play two or three sports and the ones that are single sport athletes? And I'm not looking to necessarily I really think the research shows that those that play more are actually perform better. Sure. But at the end of the day, I'm curious, more than anything, for coaches that don't like to share athletes, what's the value that you've seen getting those kids from other sports and what they can add by letting go of them for 6 months?
Yeah, I think there's sit on that one for a second, but I think especially with our football program, those kids were tough. You know, there were demands there. Those kids were up in the weight room at 6 a.m. They were the demands of what they were doing and the sacrifice they made for that program really carried over to anything they did as far as being coachable, moldable, tough, being able to grind out some adversity. But that came through hard work and some success in that sport. Yeah, I felt like that, if they were, especially in our football program at the time, and it changed quite a bit from when Nate left with the basketball program, where Nate was demanding all those things too. I thought he did a great job with that. And I think we had more multi-sport athletes back then, three sport guys, not just two. But it predominantly what ended up happening over time, we ended up with football, baseball guys, because the demand, they'd play into December every year. So by the time they were beat up physically, but I thought the carryover really was the mental toughness part.
Let me piggyback on that and ask you this. What have you learned, especially as a high school guy, right? You're on campus. You got kids that you teach that are out playing on these teams. So I'm sure you have an opportunity to watch them play and compete. What have you learned, watching other disciplines that you've been able to steal and implement as a baseball coach?
Yeah, when I took over at Oakdale, that's what we did. I had our guys in the weight room, just like our head coach. I mean, we tried to mimic that and create consistency between the programs. Even though it was a separate sport, we wanted like-minded kids. I thought that was probably the best thing those programs did throughout my time at Oakdale, whether I was the head coach or the assistant coach. That was the framework that was there. And it's a tight-knit kind of deal. Those kids, they're all friends. They all grew up together. So that environment, I thought, created a bond that other schools, maybe if they're not doing those things, didn't have when your kids take the field.
No doubt. And what I hear you saying is the off-field time translated to on-field chemistry and the way in which they were able to understand one another.
Yeah, the culture piece of that.
Yeah, go ahead and speak a little bit to that and how that impacted your culture.
Yeah, that's what it was, man. Rise and grind. Get out of bed, pack a lunch. This is what's happening. Everybody's showering here. You're going right to class. The regimen, similar to a military background. It's time for PT. Let's go, boys. And that's how your day started every day. But it created that consistent routine, number one, that carried over into both programs and how practices were set up.
All right, let's go there. You brought the military piece back into it. So how would you say that your time in the military prepared you to be a coach? And what would you say you had to learn to do differently based on that time in the military, because it didn't translate?
I'll reverse the question. I'll answer the second one first there. I had a team chief, Sergeant Pike. We just talked Father's Day, but a different cat, but always had your back, one of those things. But he was tough. When you go to the air assault school there, they teach you how to rappel and do stuff out of a helicopter. That's how we were transported all the time. But at the end, there's a 12-mile road march. And I think halfway through the course, it's like a three-week course or whatever. Halfway through, you did a 6-miler just to get you prepped for the 12-miler. And I finished like halfway in the pack, whatever. And then the 12-mile road march, they allow your platoon to come and join you on the 12-mile road march. I was excited to see my teammates. And I just started jogging. And next thing I know, I'm behind the leader. And then all of a sudden, my teammates caught up or whatever. And shit, you had a water checkpoint every 3 miles. Well, you had to drink a canteen of water before you could get the refill. So I sipped my water as I jogged. So by the time I got to the water checkpoint, I was out of water. So they filled me up. I passed the guy that was in first place. And now I'm out in the rolling hills. And I was walking up the front side of the hills and jogging down the back. And Sergeant Pike goes, "Come on, Lightning. You got to run up the front side and you'll smoke his ass mentally. Let him see you." And so that was probably the first thing I learned there about mentality. I'm playing those mind games a little bit and then figuring out how much I had in the tank. I never thought I'd win the 12-mile road march. That was probably my first insight into that. Now, what was the first question again? Sorry.
The second piece was, what did you learn that you had to adjust because it wasn't going to translate to coaching high school kids? That military mindset.
That's it. I wasn't adaptable before that moment. And that's really what that teaches you in there. No matter where they send you, they sent me to extreme cold weather training where those elements, man, you're building a thermal shelter to sleep in 50 below weather and learning how to adapt to a new environment over and over. That sucks, really, to be put it frank. Nobody wants to sleep outside in that. Subtle things like that that carried over a long way for me, especially with the coaching piece. And that's where we go into being adaptable. Being able to adjust as the game comes, something that the hitters are going to make adjustments. So our pitchers, I have to understand that. What pitches did I call 1-1 early in the game? Am I going to call that same pitch? There's a lot that goes into that and figuring out, okay, when do I need to make that adjustment here? Because it's going to happen.
Yep, no doubt. All right, let me follow with this then. Over the last 20 years, you got the exact number, but it's been a long time. How has your approach changed? How have you evolved as a coach? If you had to give one or two bullet points on this, I definitely don't do this anymore.
I'm not as reactionary. I still have it in there. Like even at the JC level, I'd buy a case of clipboards for the season. But like this year, I didn't break one clipboard. But I wrote on the bottom of one, "You can't break me." So as a reminder, hey, don't break the clipboard. You're the head guy now. Don't be reactionary. You got to stay calm. A little different when I'm the pitching coach, assistant coach, demanding something specific from our pitcher out there and having that accountability back and forth. As a head coach, I thought I needed to make an adjustment in that for sure, where I look calm and in control. That's probably the biggest adjustment I had to make.
And that brings me back to something I usually ask much earlier. When you moved over 18 inches, proverbially, what did you realize right away that you needed to figure out? You've done all the prep work forever, but now all of a sudden you're in a big kid's seat.
How do I utilize my assistant coach's strengths? That's the one thing that it took me the fall to really grasp. Okay, I might have a really good plan laid out here, but am I executing it well or not based on what assistant coaches are there that day? Because that would change every day too. They have real jobs. They had, okay, who do I have today? Consistently two or three coaches are there for sure. Those couple, is my catching guy going to make it today so I can get individual work done with them? And if he's there, that's got to be my priority in how I utilize him to make those guys better.
So what would you say that you figured out after the fall? How would you advise other coaches to use their assistants? Give us some guidance here.
I think the biggest thing for me is how the players respond to those coaches. What kind of response am I going to get from my catching coach giving him an adjustment during the game rather than me saying something from the dugout or bringing him in, having my position guy talked specifically to that player.
Right.
So instead of me doing all of that.
And that goes back to your assistant coach's strengths, right? What's the relationship with the kid like? What is their area of expertise? Are you better letting them deliver the message? And I think that's something that you learn as you go along rather than feeling like you are the holder of all information. Would you say there was a moment that allowed you to see the value of that you can point to? Or is it just something that over time you realize these guys are just here standing around if I don't empower them?
Yeah, over time, obviously, like any adjustment like that, you're going from being responsible for one piece of the puzzle. Now you're responsible for the puzzle and trying to stay organized enough with what's going on within the group to have a good plan to fit what they need. That's probably the biggest piece to that with those coaches and how I design a practice plan for whatever day. So
let me follow with this. Given what you've learned over the years, you were thrust into a head coaching role, let's say at the high school at 24 or whatever, coming out of the military, coming out of your playing career. What advice would you have for your former self to get you going on the right track rather than fumbling around and stumbling, which you're going to do anyway, people that are listening, you're not ever going to be ready. But what advice would you give yourself?
I would suggest that I sit down and really think about what that culture needs to look like before I start. And then having a good understanding of how to evaluate what is there. Because when I got out of the military, I wouldn't have seen any of that. Okay, I'll coach. Great. But you learn as you go with that. That would be the biggest piece, is that I really could sit back and initially assess what's going on here. What kind of pieces do I have? So I knew where to start from, where before I would have dove in. That's how I went about it anyways. It's all right, let's go to work. But never sat back to really see what I needed to have laid out for them.
Which is ironic, because the military example would be, hey, you need to get to this point. Here's your map. You don't just take off walking. You actually have to sit down and plan it and figure out what's going on. And I think most of us at the early stages of our career could feel very much like we did a similar thing. It's just like we just start marching. And at the end of the day, it's like, if you could figure out a game plan, what your mission and vision is, and what's the easiest way to get there, simplicity wins. And we often make things more complicated than they need to be. Mm-hmm. Finish with this. What would you say is something you have most recently changed your mind on? And it doesn't have to be baseball or coaching related. It's just a growth mindset question. Since you brought up Angela Duckworth earlier, there's another book, right, that ultimately we always try to deal with mindset and how to continue growing. So what would you say is something you most recently changed your mind on?
That's a good question.
Yeah, it's not mine. I stole it from a guy named Dave Stachowiak. So the way in which I usually frame this is, I used to be over here and now I'm over here, and here's why. There's a very intentional shift, not just happenstance.
I'm really going through that right now as we speak, career change and whatever. Am I going to go back and be a full-time teacher? Am I going to take an opportunity somewhere else? And I think what that's challenging me to do right now is to dig even deeper into what I've already started to create at a certain level, as far as mapping out that plan. How am I going to go about, if there is a next step up, what's that look like? How much research do I need to do so that I can relate, I can get development out of our guys, and can I spend enough time with them individually to have that trust? I think it's just going to get deeper, and I'm going to have to become better at sorting through that pretty quickly. So
no doubt. And I think that's the hardest. Yeah. I think that's the most challenging deal for any of us, where you're teaching and you have a full load and you're trying to find time to be with each of your kids individually and build that trust. And there's no easy solution, but it's the constant challenge and the hill that we all have to climb if we're going to try to be successful in whatever way you define that. So I appreciate you sharing that. Thanks for coming on today, Coach. I appreciate it, especially given the times that we had to move this twice, but hopefully you had a decent time there.
That was awesome. It's great to meet you.
You too, Coach.
All right. Take care.
This podcast was also brought to you by teachhoops.com. As coaches, our inboxes get flooded with noise on how to make your program better. Teachhoops.com will get you focused on what needs to get done. One thing you've heard from these podcasts is, no matter the experience, you got to keep pushing yourself to be better. Coach Steve Collins will help you direct that noise. He is there to help you. He has the credentials as a coach, and he's never turned down a Teach Hoops member. Sign up for a plan at teachhoops.com and mention us at checkout. This site is here simply to help you be better. Take advantage and see you on the court. Remember, go to teachhoops.com.
This episode is brought to you by Element, spelled L-M-N-T. What is Element? It's a delicious sugar-free electrolyte drink mix. As a coach, we are constantly trying to find the best products for our athletes to train and compete at their highest level. Element is a great alternative to other commercial recovery and performance drinks and has enough sodium, potassium, and magnesium to get you feeling and performing your best. Plus, it has zero sugar, no artificial ingredients, and is gluten-free. With eight delicious flavors, you're guaranteed to find one your taste buds will love. I know our athletes love the citrus salt. We keep a variety box in the office, and our athletes stop by every day on their way to practice and games to load up. At this point, they won't even touch another electrolyte product. Without amazing products and sponsors like Element, our podcast would not be possible. Right now, when you click on our affiliate link and place your first Element order, Element will give us 100% commission. Last thing, Element might have the best return policy on the planet. If you don't love it, you'll be instantly refunded.